Howdy there, my friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. Joining me, of course, as always, the co-hostess with the momostis, es mi amigo, Mr. Filio Filson, sitting over there. Kyle, my brother, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. It's beautiful weather. We just got done with a Little League baseball game. We lost 8-7.
Ah!
It was a very close game, and you hate to lose those, but at least the boys were trying. The Bruds, they were doing good, man.
Got some strikeouts, some tagouts.
Yeah. Jacob's pitching is really coming along. Makes me happy, you know. It's nice to be a proud father. You watch it, and you're like, come on! You know, of course, there was one play that he could have had an easy out, but he tried to pick the ball up with the glove rather than his hand, so, you know.
Yeah.
But, no, everything's going good. I feel good. The weather is nice. I mean, we've dodged the storms again.
A lot of rain and wind, but we're getting lucky.
And we've had an interesting week. We were on Into the Fray this last week. Mm-hmm. That was pretty fun. Fun to be on other shows.
It's going to air, I believe, this coming Thursday, folks. So if you're listening to this upcoming, you're going to notice earlier or later on in the week, I should say, that we'll be on there with Into the Fray with Sam and Shannon. We had a great time. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with that show, you should definitely go over there and check it out. They do similar subjects as we cover, and it's a lot of fun.
It's good friends. Yeah, the weather's getting great down here. Hope it's getting great for everybody else. Hope everybody's had a wonderful weekend. We're going to get back to the grind, get back to the groove. We're going to cover some interesting topics and hopefully make y'all's week pass pretty good. Kyle was telling me about, look, when he first brought it up, I kind of started laughing because I thought of that clip. What with the Big Lebowski? Remember when he's in the tub and he's like nice marmot whenever they come in there?
Yeah.
That's what I thought of. Lay it on the folks of what's gone down.
Yeah, I love these stories where animals intervene in science and stuff. Well, apparently, a small mammal has recently sabotaged the world's most powerful scientific instrument. Now, get this, Cam. The Large Hadron Collider, a 17-mile superconducting machine, which is designed to smash protons together at close to the speed of light, went offline the other night. And engineers, wondering what the heck it was, started investigating to see what could be cause of this, and they found the remains of a furry creature near a gnawed-through power cable. They said that we had electrical problems, and we were pretty sure this was caused by a very small animal. And this, you know, is a $7 billion particle collider in Switzerland, and all it takes is one little weasel to gnaw through some wires, and it knocked the whole thing offline. Now, they don't know it was a weasel because they said the remains they found were kind of charred, kind of cooked.
Yeah.
But they think it was a weasel. And they said that this kind of thing happens from time to time because where it's at, just outside of Geneva, Switzerland, is in the country, kind of. So they say that this isn't the first time. They said a couple years ago, a bird actually flew over and dropped a baguette, and it landed on some electrical equipment and knocked the thing offline. They also said that in 2006, a group of raccoons conducted a coordinated attack on a particle accelerator in Illinois. So from time to time...
Mother Nature not wanting us to do this, man.
Well, that's what they're talking about. They're joking and saying it's unclear whether or not these animals are actually trying to stop humanity from unlocking the secrets of the universe. Because, you know, at this collider, that's what they're trying to detect, right? This Higgs boson particle.
Yeah.
That it's a theorized particle, but they've never actually seen it. And that's what they're doing with this thing. Do you remember when they were going to build a super collider right here by us in Waxahachie?
Yeah.
Remember that?
I remember when all that was going down.
I wish they would have. That would have been really cool.
I don't want baguette dropping birds flying over here. Come on now.
No, but it would be neat if they could open up a wormhole to another dimension. Because remember the fear of that? Was they were going to create a black hole?
Tear a hole in time space.
Yeah. They've been testing for a while now, and nothing like that has ever happened. But anyway, it's pretty funny. I love this. We would like an animal gnawing through power cables disrupted the whole thing. Pretty funny.
We had that go down here in Weatherford at one point several years ago when I was still working here, you know, of course, work for the city here. We got some pictures. It knocked a whole, like, transmission station offline for electrical.
Oh, really?
Yeah, transmission. It's like half the whole city went dark.
What was the culprit?
A squirrel.
A squirrel.
A squirrel had gotten in somewhere, and had reached, like, across two lines and basically created the whole circuit, you know, and it just burned up a bunch of stuff. But we laughed because of that, because it was the same way, is it was like little pieces of what was left of it. It's just hilarious. Yeah, I mean, it was.
Dude,
I felt bad for the squirrel, but now they make these cone looking things that they put on everything. It was just, it's one of those things that, you know, Mother Nature has a way of saying, you know, not today, Satan, and it ends up just knocking everything offline.
You know, I almost was in a bad car wreck about 2 years ago. I was following a woman and she locked them up. And I was, you know, it is, you're driving, glancing at your cell phone or something. Wasn't paying quite attention, looking off in the distance as I often do, staring with my jaw open. I glanced ahead and I saw that the woman was locked up, so I had to lock up my brakes. And, you know, you're immediately just like, oh, God. And then you're like, well, what is she doing? There was a squirrel crossing the road. She didn't want to hit the squirrel. And I'm like, gosh darn it, man. It's just a squirrel. And I wonder why, you know, squirrels are basically just rats, but because they have a fuzzy tail, people,
that's why.
They
that's
give
why
them the
loved.
Pass. You know, yeah. They're like, oh, yeah, it's not a vermin.
Yeah.
It's not a varmint. Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's, I always laugh about like the same thing. It's a rat with a furry tail. If a possum had a fuzzy tail, would you call it a raccoon? Everybody's like, a raccoon's cute, but a possum's ugly. You're like, nah, not so much.
Yeah. Right?
Of course, I've seen, you know, possums are nasty. But I'll tell you something that we could probably use, Kyle.
Okay.
To pick up the remains of that squirrel from that Hadron Collider. This comes from NewScientist.com. Chris Beinuck writes about this. Its nimble-fingered robot hands could help clean up nuclear waste. That's right, folks. You've heard it here, and it's true that there's nothing quite like the human touch, boy. And Kyle can tell you all about that. But anyhow, that's why he goes to the massage parlors. But anyway, nimble-fingered robots that exactly mimic the movements of a hand, a human hand, could soon be used to help decommission nuclear power stations. You hear that, Kyle? No more going down here to these shady rub-and-tug parlors. You can get you a robot hand.
Oh, yeah?
Remote-controlled robots with hand-like manipulators are used in many situations, they say, that are difficult or dangerous for humans, like bomb disposal and such. We've talked about all that. But it says that their movements are typically controlled by human operators through, of course, anything else, joysticks. You know, you've all seen it looks like a remote control car and they're trying to drive the bomb disposal thing and all that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Well, you know, it doesn't work because you don't have the same feeling. And you got to imagine, like, if you could wear a glove, well, that's what they're doing with. Mika Pereira and Hamad Zahira at the London firm Cambrian Intelligence have built a system that lets robotic arms and hands emulate the hand movement exact. It says, now to guide the robot, a human carries out the desired actions either in front of a video camera or while wearing a glove that captures movement. Now the system, says, which works with a range of existing robotic hands, mimics the movements as the human makes them. And they've actually got some video of this, folks. You can go check it out. But it says the robot's movements, of course, are often more, as they say, even more fluid than a human's, since the software smooths out any sudden or jerky actions made by the human. So you got to imagine, it would be laggy, you know, and tink, tink, tink.
Yeah.
Now they've got a software designed where it's not, to where it flows. Now, Pereira actually says this. He says, robotic hands with human-like dexterity are needed in environments where it's difficult or impossible for humans to work. Now, where he starts talking about is places like oil and gas industry there in the North Sea. He said nimble fingers could also be useful in the textile industry, where making delicate clothes is still too difficult for robots. But they say that the first may be to benefit is the nuclear industry. Now, they hope to develop a system for use with the Sellafield, a British company that decommissions nuclear power stations. Now, Tom Robinson, he works for Sellafield. He's a researcher there, and he says, we just can't handle certain facilities and materials with human beings. The radiation levels are too high. Well, Pereira says that the idea would be to send in a robot while a human operator wearing a virtual reality headset moved the robot arms as if they were his own. So you and I have talked about these headsets before and where they're going to go. Well, look at where it's going.
Yeah.
Now, Cambrian Intelligence, they say they're working on a system that goes beyond merely mimicking a human to using its dexterity in novel situations. And Pereira says this, you can just show the robot how to unscrew something, and after the robot has learned the action, it can do that action again on its own. So it's AI. So instantly, when I read all this, the first thing I thought of was what? Robotic warriors. Now you're going to teach a whole group of robots hand-to-hand combat. They get it the first time.
You get Marcelo Garcia to go in there and start teaching them how to roll.
Exactly. John Jones throwing head kicks at people. So then you're going to start taking stuff along those lines, and then you're going to put one of the generals is going to be one of the main leaders in a robotic VR suit. So he's leading them where he wants them to go, and then he's just pointing it out, and they're all the way across wherever they are, and now they're marching across the countryside, just destroying things. At least that's in my crazy Terminator music mind. But it is pretty neat that they could use them to go in there and not only, you know, just decommission and take down all the stuff in a nuclear plant, but I instantly thought of search and rescue. Imagine, like we talked about, having robots. Well, now you got robots that you can actually feel exactly what they feel, except you have the strength of hydraulics and robots. So you're moving rubble and getting in there to where you can feel people and all that. So, I mean, it's, folks, prepare yourself. Buckle up. Get your EMPs ready. It's coming.
I want to be able to drive a big robot. Like, what was that ridiculous movie from a couple years ago? I remember watching, like,
Pacific Rim.
Yeah, I think that was it. It was on cable one night. This was years ago. And I think I watched 20 minutes of it. I had to turn it off.
I've watched the whole thing a couple of times. You just got to go with it, man. You got to dispel
it. You've
watched
it several times?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Man.
The main reason is because I like the steampunk lookish stuff whenever they're like, they're trying to find whatever these creatures are. I can't remember the guy's name. He played Hellboy. I just went totally blank on the guy's name. But he's in it, and he's like one of the dealers, and they deal in all this black market stuff. I like the things like that. It's pretty cool.
I thought it was terrible. Well, let's move on, folks. A Kansas witness in Clearwater, Kansas, recalled a UFO incident from the 1960s when she and two family members had an encounter with a disc-shaped UFO that shot a beam of light inside of their vehicle. Now, this comes to us from Open Minds over there, and it's pretty neat. They said that the witness was driving eastbound through Clearwater at about 8 p.m. in March of 1966 when we noticed a very black object hovering above the power lines along the train track. It had small windows and was lit up on the inside. Now, all three family members reacted about the same time, asking, "What is that?" The object then started to travel in the direction of their car. It flew over their car, hovered in front of the car, on the closest to the passenger side, and they said that my brother had either stopped the car or they stopped the car, I don't know, and there was a very bright yellow beam of light that was directed at the car and lit up the entire inside. We all sat very still and didn't move until I looked at my brother and said, "Don't stare, just go." Now, about that time, a yellow beam of light went out and a door in the bottom of the object closed. Then the object took off at a 45-degree angle and dissipated into the air in about 3 seconds. The car started, and we started traveling east on a rural road. We were all silent, and I remember feeling angry, nauseated, and upset at the incident. I didn't even want to think about it because it was so unpleasant. Now, another family member attempted to find out what happened. And they said when we got home, my mother called the Air Force base close to our home, and they denied having any knowledge of anything. I'm an elderly woman who has always wanted an explanation as to what this was, but I doubt I ever will really know. There were no cell phones in those days to take pictures. So that's pretty creepy, right?
That's pretty wild, yeah.
It sounds like the typical case. How many times do people spot these UFOs hovering over power lines or a power plant? We've even talked about that people have saw where it looked like the actual UFO was somehow recharging its batteries or drawing power or energy from the power plant.
It's what makes, I don't know, man. I just have this some kind of, like I said, gut feeling that it's something that's from this, like, that we've made.
Maybe I know what you're saying. Me too.
Traveler, that it's not something extraterrestrial, that it's something maybe interdimensional, but not from deep, deep space. Because I keep thinking about when they do see those things and do it, I'm like, why would they be doing it? You know, well, maybe it's because that's kind of how we designed it before they started going back in the history, you know, coming from the future.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it is fascinating because there are numerous ones that are like that. Philly, you and I have covered this in the past, and I know all the listeners are probably up to snuff on this whole thing because we've talked about Kennewick Man. We've discussed it numerous times where they thought they had found, well, apparently now they have done it. They've dropped the hammer. That's it.
Now, before you start, I want to just make sure that I have the story. Isn't the Kennewick Man where two guys were going to watch like a powerboat racing and they were drinking a little bit of beer and they saw a skull in like the water? Is that the story?
And they found the remains and all that. And then people were saying that it's about 8,000 or 8,500 years old and all this stuff. It was discovered along the Columbia River.
Yeah, that's it. Right, yeah.
In Washington. They're in Kennewick, Washington. Okay, this is what happens. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers actually took control of it, okay?
Okay.
And because the Native Americans were like, that's ours, we got to put it back in there. And they were like, people were arguing. Remember them? The colleges was like, we got to test it because it may be an earlier visitor to this country. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers said this past Wednesday, they opened the process for returning to the tribe for burial, the oldest and, they say, most complete set of bones ever found in North America.
Oh, so it was returned to the Native Americans.
The Northwestern Division, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, said its decision was based on a review of new information, particularly recently published DNA and skeletal analysis, and that they're going to go along with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Now, like we talked about, the bones will remain in the Burke Museum there in Seattle until the Corps determines which tribe will receive them. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Michelle Coffey is a spokeswoman for the Corps there in Portland, Oregon. She says that the next step is for interested tribes to submit a claim to acquire the skeleton for burial. But determining which tribe receives the bones is likely to be a lengthy process. Now, of course, in the past, the Colville, the Yakama, the Utamatilla, Nez Perce, or Nez Perce, and the Wanapu Indians have all laid claim to a connection to them.
Right.
But Coffey says that we still have a lot of work to do. Jody Gowdy, which I believe we've spoken about that person before, is the Yakama Nation. The chairman for them says, obviously, that we are hearing an acknowledgement from the Corps of what we have been saying for 20 years. Now we want to collectively do what is right and bring our relative back for reburial. Now, here's a neat thing here. It says that new genetic evidence determined the remains were closer to modern. And this is going to make, there's going to be a thing here. That I want you to listen to this. Determined that it was closer to modern Native Americans than any other population in the world. Following that, the Corps began to re-examine Kennewick Man status, it says. Now, Brigadier General Scott A. Spellman, he's a commander of the Corps in the Northwestern Division, says that I am confident that our review and analysis of new skeletal, statistical, and genetic evidence have convincingly led to a Native American determination. Now, of course, it says most scientists trace the modern native groups to Siberian ancestors that arrived. Of course, you know, talk about the land bridge. We've discussed that. It says, but there are some features of Kennewick Man's skull that led some scientists to suggest a man's ancestors came from elsewhere. So that's when they went to doing the DNA and that they recovered DNA from a fragment of a hand bone. And they've done all this and they pretty much compared it to the modern DNA, like I said, of the native peoples here in Americas. The results, and this is what they claim at the very end of this article, from phys.org, that the results showed a greater similarity to DNA from the Americas than from anywhere else, with a close relationship to at least one Native American population, the Colvilles there in Washington State. Now, there's something about that last part that I'm going to think out loud with all you guys, and I want to talk to you about it too, Kyle. It says it showed a greater similarity. It didn't say that's what it is. It says a greater similarity, okay?
Right.
Didn't say that this is exactly what it is, but that it shows a close relationship. Well, let me ask you this. If there was an earlier group of people here and they interbred with the existing natives, wouldn't they already then have a more, I guess, greater similarity in DNA to that? It doesn't necessarily mean that that's their tribe. It just means that maybe that those people came from the same group as they were bred, correct?
Right, the stock.
So, exactly. So, what I'm saying is, I don't think it's quite as clear and cut and defined as what they make it out to be. But also, I'm also not saying that they're not right. Part of me, and I'm not going to lie, really wanted this to be from some completely place else, to be a thing out of time, for it not to fit. Kennewick Man's remains to come from some other country, and they'd just be like, we don't know how it got here. We can't believe it's 8,500 years old. But I can't continue to, you know, to
it doesn't look like that's what happened.
It doesn't
though,
look
right?
like that's what happened. No. What it looks like is it was an earlier,
you know,
an earlier version of these tribes. Still doesn't mean that that's not where they came from, you know, that right. they didn't come from someplace else. But, you know, it kind of squashed my hopes and dreams. But you know what? My hat's off to you. The people did a great job scientifically proving that, you know, he is part of this group of people, and more than likely that they're going to gather him back up and he needs to be reburied, repatriated with his peoples. So, you know, good job. It just, you know, it's one of those things you're like, yeah. Oh, so close, man. But maybe we can find another one anyway. We'll keep going.
Yeah, and I think it'll always remain a mystery. And speaking of mysteries, on today's show, we're going to be exploring one of my favorite missing person cases, the case of D.B. Cooper. Let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, we're going to be discussing that. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. On the afternoon
of November 24th, 1971. A man identifying himself as Dan Cooper purchased a one-way ticket from Portland, Oregon to Seattle, Washington. He boarded Northwest Airlines Flight 305, a Boeing 727, carrying only a briefcase and wearing a suit with a black overcoat. Cooper took a seat in the rear of the plane. Once in flight, he lit a cigarette and ordered a drink from the flight attendant. After receiving and paying for his drink, Cooper passed a note to the flight attendant, which stated that he had a bomb. The note went on to say that he wanted $200,000 in $20 bills, two parachutes, upon landing in Seattle. Wearing sunglasses, the mystery man remained calm and cordial to all the flight attendants. Once on the ground in Seattle, the FBI provided the ransom money after thoroughly documenting and photographing each one of the bills. Two parachutes were provided to the hijacker, and the plane was refueled. Upon receiving all of his ransom demands, Cooper released all of the passengers and flight attendants. All who remained on the plane were the pilot, co-pilot, the flight engineer, and one flight attendant. He then instructed the pilots to fly towards Mexico City at 200 miles per hour and at an altitude of 10,000 feet. The hijacked airliner took off from Seattle at 7:40 p.m., with the flight crew under instructions to stay in the cockpit. Shortly after takeoff, flight attendant Mucklow observed the hijacker tying something to his body. At 8 p.m., the rear staircase indicator light came on in the cockpit as the rear staircase of the craft was being lowered manually from inside the aircraft. At 8:13 p.m., with two parachutes and 21 pounds of ransom money in hand, Dan Cooper jumped into history. In the days following the hijacking, the FBI began to investigate the crime. A search of the plane yielded very few clues, but it was discovered that before jumping from the aircraft, Cooper had removed his tie. Many witnesses were questioned, and on the hunch, detectives believed it to be a Portland, Oregon man named D.B. Cooper. Anxious reporters put the man's name out as a person of interest, and the name D.B. Cooper has been attached to the hijacking and Dan Cooper ever since the crime was perpetrated. With help from the U.S. Air Force, the FBI recreated the jump conditions of the jump and placed his landing in an area around Lake Merwin near Ariel, Washington. The FBI, with help from state and local law enforcement, the U.S. Air Force, and the National Guard, began to comb the woods in the area of the supposed landing site of Mr. Dan Cooper. The searches, eyewitness questioning, suspect lists, and a trace of the numbered bills used to pay the ransom failed to yield any leads at all. And to this day, the hijacking of Flight 305 by Dan Cooper remains an open case. Sometime later, in 1978, deer hunters near Castle Rock, Washington, discovered the information placard from the rear staircase of Flight 305. Castle Rock is located just north of Lake Merwin. Then again in 1980, $5,800 of the ransom money, exactly 290 bills, were found buried on a sandy shore of the Columbia River near Vancouver, Washington, over 20 miles from Lake Merwin. The money was deteriorated and waterlogged, but was still bundled in the original packing. Over 194,000, or 9,700 bills, from the ransom have never been discovered. In 2008, a piece of parachute found near Amboy, Washington, 6 miles from Lake Merwin, is believed to be one of the two parachutes that Dan Cooper used in his escape from the hijacked airplane. these items, the money, the placard, and the parachute, are the only evidence that has ever been located in connection with the crime. Then, in 2011, an Oklahoma City woman, Marla Cooper, came forward to claim that her uncle, Lynn Doyle Cooper, generally known as LD, was in fact D.B. Cooper of the 1971 hijacking. Lynn Doyle Cooper was known to be a huge fan of the French comic book character Dan Cooper, who was a skydiving hero. LD was an avid outdoorsman and a logger who was raised in the small town of Sisters, Oregon. He was very familiar with the Northwest woods and possessed the survival skills that would be needed to get out of the area following a parachute landing. Marla Cooper believes that he lost control of the money after jumping from Flight 305, explaining why the money has never made it back into any circulation. Marla states that LD and another one of her uncles left her grandmother's house on the morning of November 24th, 1971, to go on a turkey hunting trip, and then later returned on the 25th, bruised and bloody, claiming that they had both been in a car crash. Shortly after that, LD Cooper disappeared and was never seen by the family again.
I'm certain he was my uncle.
This is not an alias.
No.
You believe that your uncle was D.B. Cooper?
Yes, I do.
Marla Cooper says she now remembers a conversation with her father before he died in 1995 that she didn't fully understand at the time.
My father made a comment about his long-lost brother, my uncle L.D., and said that he thought he was still alive but hiding from the FBI. And I questioned why he would be hiding. He said, don't you remember he hijacked that airplane? A couple of years ago, my mother made a similar comment.
Why have you decided to come forward?
Actually, I contacted the FBI as soon as I was sure that what I was remembering were real memories. There's a crime that's taken place that hasn't been solved, and I'm the only person, as far as I know, who knows what happened.
Marla was 8 at the time of the hijacking.
My two uncles, who I only saw at holiday time, were planning something very mischievous. They left to supposedly go turkey hunting, and Thanksgiving morning I was waiting for them to return. My uncle LD was wearing a white t-shirt, and he was bloody and bruised and a mess, and I was horrified. I began to cry, and my other uncle, who was with LD, said, Marla, just shut up and go get your dad.
There were some clues, however. Cooper left his tie draped over the plane seat and a few cigarette butts left in the ashtray. But it was still several years before technology was advanced enough to extract DNA from both of these. The FBI also found fingerprints, a strand of hair. But again, until forensic technology caught up, the strand of hair was useless. FBI agents who have worked on the Cooper case over the years differ in their opinions as to what happened to him. Special Agent Larry Carr, who spent several years running the Cooper investigation, thought he must have died when he jumped, as he was wearing just a suit, which would have afforded him little protection against the natural elements. We originally thought Cooper was an experienced jumper, perhaps even a paratrooper. We concluded, after a few years, that this simply was not true. No experienced parachutist would have jumped in the pitch black night, in the rain, with a 200 mile an hour wind in his face, wearing only loafers and a trench coat. It was simply too risky. He also missed that his reserve chute was only for training and had been sewn shut. This is something that a skilled skydiver would have checked. And even if he did make it to the ground alive, it was winter. He was dressed for air travel, not forced survival. It's almost certain he had no accomplices waiting to meet him. For one thing, there would have been no way for anyone to track his location. His instructions to the pilot were, fly to Mexico. And he jumped at a random location with zero ground visibility. Diving into the wilderness without a plan, without the right equipment, in such terrible conditions, he probably never even got his chute open. Not all FBI agents are convinced that he died, though, or agree with Special Agent Carr. As for suspects, there have been more than 1,000 over the past 4 decades. One of those was military veteran William Gossett. He had parachute training and was widely known to be obsessed with the Cooper hijacking. Towards the end of his life, he reportedly told his sons and a retired judge that he was in fact the hijacker. According to the attorney and Cooper sleuth Galen Cook, Gossett also owned a safety deposit box which contained $200,000, and that he ended his days on the run in Utah. The FBI, however, says there is no firm evidence implicating Gossett at all. Another suspect is Kenny Christensen, a former paratrooper who died in 1994. 8 years ago, after watching a documentary on the Cooper case on television, Christensen's brother, Lyle, became convinced his elder sibling was in fact Cooper. His efforts to persuade the FBI, however, proved futile, so he contacted a private investigator called Skip Porteous, who ended up publishing a book on the theory called Into the Blast. Now, after the Second World War, Christensen had joined Northwest Orient, first as a mechanic and then as a flight attendant and purser. Christensen reportedly bought a house with cash a few months after hijacking. After the hijacking, something his brother claims he couldn't have afforded, and on his deathbed, told him there was something you should know, but would never say what it was. There were also those who were inspired by D.B. Cooper. His daring escape inspired no small amount of copycat crimes. The most high profile was perpetrated by a man who some suspected wasn't a copycat at all, Richard Floyd McCoy Jr. He was a Vietnam veteran, a former Green Beret, and a helicopter pilot and avid skydiver. He was studying law at Brigham Young University. McCoy hijacked an airplane in 1972 and parashooted to freedom with $500,000, but was captured days later, having left behind way more evidence than whoever committed the 1971 heist. Convicted of the 1972 crime, he busted out of jail in August of 1974 and was killed in 3 months by an FBI shootout. Though his age, 29 at the time of the Cooper hijack, and the fact that he had an alibi cast some serious doubts, a 1991 book about his exploits raised his rankings on the Who Was D.B. Cooper. Now, a book named D.B. Cooper, The Real McCoy, co-authored by an ex-FBI agent named Russell Calamay, was published in 1991. The book made the case that Cooper and McCoy were really one and the same person, citing similar methods of hijacking and a tie left by Cooper similar to those worn by Brigham Young students. The author also said that McCoy never admitted nor denied he was Cooper, and when McCoy was directly asked whether he was Cooper, he replied, "I don't want to talk to you about it." Now, the agent who killed McCoy is quoted as saying, "When I shot Richard McCoy, I shot D.B. Cooper at the same time." The widow of Richard McCoy, Karen Burns McCoy, sued and won a settlement from both the book's co-authors and its publisher. Recently, another person has come forward claiming that they know who D.B. Cooper really was and is. Chael Sonnen. That's right, Chael Sonnen, the retired mixed martial artist who fought in the light heavyweight division in the UFC. He was recently on the Joe Rogan Experience, which is another podcast, and he told a very interesting story. Here's a clip of that conversation.
Now I want to tell you this story. Can
please.
Okay. So I wrote this book, The Voice of Reason, which comes out tomorrow. Let me give myself a cheap
a VIP pass to enlightenment.
Thank you very much. VIP pass to enlightenment hits the bookshelves tomorrow. It's available right now at Amazon.com. This isn't a plug for the book. That was the plug. I'm done. Okay. I'm going to tell you a story, and I've only told this story twice in my life, so I don't know if I'm good at telling it. I told this. See, when you write a book these days, you don't actually have to write anything. You talk it all out. It all goes into the, you know, stensive, whatever they call it, and then they go back and they type it out for you. So I tell this story, and I know who D.B. Cooper is, okay? I know who D.B. Cooper is. My whole family knows, and it's been like a family secret or however for a number of years.
So you know who the guy is?
I know who he is. He's alive and well. And a lot of times over the past few years, somebody will be on their deathbed. You know, this just happened about 4 years ago. A guy's on his deathbed, and he comes out and says, I'm D.B. Cooper, and he tells his whole family, and they go to the media, and the media jumps behind and says, well, it must be true, because why else would you want to go down as a criminal on your deathbed? And I'm sitting there, and I told everybody that would listen, when they look into these facts that this guy's putting out, I assure you, that won't be D.B. I told everybody, but I never told them why. I never told them how I was so confident. It's my big, big worldwide news. D.B. Cooper case finally saw. And then they unraveled it, and sure enough, it wasn't. But I told everybody that wasn't him. Well, the reason I knew it wasn't him is I know who D.B. Cooper is. My whole family knew, and it was a secret, and my father passed away. So now now my oath to keep it a secret has also passed away. I don't feel that I can't reveal this story. He's alive and well. I know exactly who he is. So I tell the story in my book. And, you know, there's a lot of things that happened in the D.B. Cooper case, and so I need to really make this shorter. I could take up your whole show with this, but
for folks who don't know who D.B. Cooper is, why don't you explain that?
Very famous. Well, he's the world's most famous hijacker, and I believe he's the most famous, one, because he was never caught, but two, he may have been the first hijacker. You know, I want to say this happened like in the 70s, and D.B. Cooper hijacks a plane. He makes it through security. You know, security's totally different back then. Gets on board. He's in a cheap disguise. He orders the plane be touched down, says he's got a device, you know, a bomb in his bag, shows it to a flight attendant. They touch down. There he is. Brings him up on that. Now, that's a sketch deposit. Of course, nobody knows what he actually looks like, but that's the sketch deposit, if the viewers can see that. So, at any rate, they touch the plane down. They bring him his $200,000 in cash and unmarked bills, and they go back up. Well, while they're up, he parachutes. They don't know he's got a parachute. Now, where the story gets interesting is he was never found, but the money wasn't either. No sign of him was found. His parachute wasn't found. His body wasn't found. And one of the things that was a problem is where he jumped was a mass forest. I mean, miles upon miles, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square acres of nothing but forest. So basically, what any expert would say is, look, he didn't make it. If he even made the fall, he would have been eaten by coyotes or bears. There's good reason why we never found his body, and it's not because he made it out of there alive. Okay, now you need a couple of those details. So, how do I know him? Well, a family friend, and I put this all in the book. I put all of this in the book, and the publisher didn't use it. And the reason he wouldn't use it is because I won't tell the name. I tell the whole story, and I'm about to do that for you now, but I don't reveal the name. And he goes, without a name, I can't use it. I go, wait.
That's ridiculous.
I can touch on every single detail. You know, and I'm telling my publisher, going, hey, I don't think you know who D.B. Cooper is. I think you should Google him. You know, there's movies made on him. Prison Break just had a character pretending to be D.B. Cooper. Folklore has been made out of this guy. Well, where this guy jumped was government land. But that land backed up to Indian land, and this gentleman was part Indian, and he grew up in this forest. This is where he spent his summers. Months after months, they would go out and camp in there, you know, in between school breaks, from the time he was a little kid all the way on. He knew right where he was jumping, and if anybody could have made it, it was this guy. Now, my dad grew up with this guy. He was a family friend. And back then, parachuting, well, much like now, is very uncommon. If somebody does it, you go tell all your friends, I found this parachuting class, and I'm going to do it. They take pictures, and they show it up. This guy was taking parachuting lessons. He didn't tell anybody. And he started taking motorcycle classes and stuff. He wasn't telling anybody. He was racing these bikes. And that's what my dad personally believes, though he never got the story, that he parachuted, had a hidden motorcycle, and rolled it out. That's my dad's personal theory. So, you know, all this stuff comes down, and many years later, the statute of limitations is up, and all of a sudden this guy starts collecting a pretty good assortment of toys, from shotguns to four-wheelers to motorhomes. My dad's known him his whole life. He knows what the guy does for a living. He knows what his wife does, and he what the heck's going on here? You know, how come, where are you getting all this money? And the guy says, well, you know, I'm an Indian. And when you reach a certain age, you get some Indian money. And there's some truth to that. There is Indian money that's given out if you're a native living in America. But you're talking about like $1,800 a year. And when you get older, about $3,000 a year. This guy came into a wide assortment of money. Well, the sketches came out of D.B. Cooper, and it's a spitting image of the guy.
That picture that we looked at?
Yeah. It's just, well, there was different ones of him in the disguise with the mustache and the whole bit. But they're going, hey, wait a minute, this looks just like you. So, you know, one night my aunt asks him. They're at dinner. They're all family friends. My parents are there. My aunt and uncle are there. This guy and his wife are there. My aunt looks across the table and flat out says, are you D.B. Cooper? And he said no. But the way that he said no told everybody there that he was, and they never brought it up again, ever. Now, as it came out, and my uncle asked him a little bit in private, hey, well, you know, that other night we were having some Chinese food, and you, well, my parents and uncles weren't the only one that thought he was. The government did too. So the FBI had visited this guy, and then he even moved away for a while, went to Arizona, and then slowly came back. But, you know, he was talked to by the FBI. They thought he was D.B. Cooper as well. So when my dad was on his deathbed, you know, he and I had a, you know, you ask me whatever you want, I'll ask you, and I'll tell you how the story really happened. You know, it's a bit of a fun moment between father and son. Everybody leaves the room and say, hey, Dad, what really happened that night when you came in at 2 a.m. smelling like bourbon? You know? Hey, what really happened that day the principal called and claimed that you and your friends were? So we kind of go back and forth, and I ask him flat out, is blah, blah, blah D.B. Cooper? And my dad said, well, all the evidence is saying that he is. Your uncle believes it, your aunt believes it, and your mom believes it. I don't think he had the courage. I don't think he was. So my dad's final ruling on his deathbed was no. He said he wasn't. But he's D.B. Cooper. I know
really?
D.B. Cooper. Absolutely.
Unfortunately, Chael does not release the man's name. It seems that even today, 45 years later, this mystery remains unsolved. Meaning that D.B. Cooper is still the most successful hijacker in American history. Special Agent Larry Carr has a few words on the case.
My name's Larry Carr. I'm the case agent for the D.B. Cooper case out of the FBI's Seattle office. You know, you have D.B. Cooper walking down the stairs. As soon as he's standing there, he really can't feel the wind coming around him from the plane going 200 miles an hour. And so when he jumps out of the aircraft, I think he just started tumbling right then. Just tumbling, panics. And once you panic, you know, you really can't do anything. So he's falling. He doesn't know where he's at. He can't see. He has no visual reference on the ground. He's out of control in the air and starts to panic, can't pull his chute, and hits the ground with never opening his chute. You know, I hope by going public, people see the evidence. I mean, there's a whole generation out there, maybe two generations now, that have no idea who D.B. Cooper is. And so hopefully by going public, you know, people will be, the case will be reinvigorated. Maybe someone that has some knowledge about it that doesn't even know they have knowledge about it will come forward and provide that one missing piece of the puzzle.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope everybody enjoyed the D.B. Cooper mystery. One of my favorite stories, very mysterious, still unsolved. I guess that's some of my favorite, you know, when it comes to crime, is the fact that it's still unsolved. No one really knows who D.B. Cooper was. Well, I will say that the one guy that came ahead, that came forward and claimed that he was, in fact, D.B. Cooper, and that had the $200,000 in his safety deposit box, William Gossett. What's funny to me about that story is that they found $200,000 when, in fact, you know, we know now that they found some of that money in the beach on the river, you know, on the banks of the Columbia River. So he wouldn't have had $200,000. He had less than that. It was, if he made away with all the money other than that money that was found on the shores of that river, it would have only been $194,000 or so. So, you know, it still remains a mystery. It's very, very interesting how dozens of people have come forward. They say even, you know, there was 1,000 different suspects, but dozens of people have come forward claiming on their deathbed that they were, in fact, D.B. Cooper. It just seems odd to me. We always talk about it on the show, that there's always these deathbed
confessions, whether I was D.B. Cooper or I was working for the Army and I saw the aliens at Roswell. You always have these stories. So again, more, it muddies up the water. You seem to know less at the end than you did at the beginning. But there's always these people, for whatever reason, like to plant a little seed of mystery as they die. Anyways, a very interesting story. I love this mystery. I remember seeing it for the first time on Unsolved Mysteries when I was a kid. And I still find the story captivating today.
Well, Philly, I got something else I want to share with you, man.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you go into the grocery store, and we're all guilty of this. Everybody goes to the grocery store. The first thing that you always notice about the fruit, any fruits and vegetables there, are that they're basically blemish-free. They're beautiful, right?
Right, yeah.
I mean, they look like they've been, each one's been handcrafted. Where if any of you know that you've got your own garden and fruit trees, they don't really look like that, okay? You know, that they're not always perfectly the same shape, or they don't always form exactly perfect. Like, I mean, you could row up bell peppers in the grocery store and you wouldn't, you know, they all look identical. Like, you just cloned a bell pepper. Well, there's an article here from the NPR that says this, and this is really interesting, folks. And I want you to think about this next time you're running out to the farmer's market. Instead of going to the grocery store, visit the farmer's markets local. Beneath an ugly outside, it says marred fruit may pack more nutrition. Now, there's an orchardist named Eliza Greenman. Now, she walked through the field talking about all this stuff. And this is one of her quotes. Says, I'm absolutely infatuated with the idea of stress in an orchard. Now, she actually grows and does custom grafts and pesticide-free hard cider apples. Now, it's an unofficial experiment, they say, but she basically tested scabbed and unscabbed Parma apples, a high-sugar variety native to southwestern Virginia, and found this, that scarred apples have a 2 to 5% higher sugar content than unharmed apples from the same tree. And more sugar means a higher alcohol content once fermented, producing a tastier hard cider. Now, she says she loves ugly apples for another reason, that they may be actually more nutritious and higher in antioxidant content, and that she believes that stress can help create super fruit. Hmm. That's right, folks. She says ugly fruits and vegetables are today's pocked and scaly, dimpled, misshaped darlings, they call it, Mir, and this. And it says the salt is actually reported that we toss out enough food, I'm assuming they're talking maybe here in the U.S., to fill 44 skyscrapers each year. Wow. This is why waste perfectly good food. And in April, a handful of Whole Food store in California said they will sell cosmetically marred but nutritious produce for the first time. So finally, people have realized, look, it's not about physical appearance. What do we always teach our kids? Don't judge a book by its cover. You know, you never get to know somebody just by looking at them and all that. Well, we can't treat our food the same way. Turns out this. In a 2014 review of 343 studies, it found that organic produce had lower pesticide residual and a 20 to 40% higher antioxidant content than conventional produce.
That's crazy.
Right?
I mean, I know that, you know, my Caleb, yes, my 8-year-old, he, you know, if he sees a banana with blemishes like that or a bruised brown spots, he's always like, you want to eat this part, Dad? I'm always like, sure, it doesn't matter to me. But it's funny that those actual imperfections and bruised areas, yes, actually hold more nutrients.
Yes.
That's incredible.
They've been studying the apple, like the peels from apples, where they were showing where they were kind of beat up and all stuff. And it actually showed, I guess what it is they send more stuff that way to fight whatever they're trying to, much like the human body.
Yeah.
Whatever's trying to do. And it just kind of builds it up. Now, Brian Ward is at the Clemson University. He's an environmental biologist. He says that there are so many factors contributing to antioxidant content, though. So what he says is this doesn't mean that we should turn away from conventional agriculture or that make hard and fast assumptions about crops because of that reason right there. But they have done some research in conventional and organic. He says the most important factor is the plant itself and the variety. That's genetic. Then there are soil, mineral content, conventional organic fertilizer, you know, so on and so on. Said that there is some interesting data that when plants are stressed by insects or disease, they produce metabolites that are good for us. So there's some people saying, look, it does sound great, but don't knee-jerk just yet and throw out all conventional, you know, stuff. But I think it does say something when everybody's on the idea of GMO and anti-GMO and all this. You kind of got to, you know,
right,
don't just because it's a GMO, don't instantly go, we can never eat it. You know, there are some good things that have come from stuff like that. You've got to educate yourself on each and everything. If you like apples, take a little time, educate yourself on the benefits, pros and cons of apples. And the same thing for oranges and bananas. But I'm with you. What the fruit looks like and beta, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, it's just like bananas get dark. I don't care. I just eat the whole thing. It doesn't matter. It's still a banana, right? Yeah. Okay. I'm good.
That is.
It's neat.
It is. It's pretty cool. Well, I would like to thank everybody for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. We're so glad you're here. We like to bring these information, these crazy stories up just to let people think about, you know, what if, what happened here, and, you know, formulate your own ideas. If you really like Expanded Perspectives, don't forget we offer Expanded Perspectives Elite. It's an additional show every Thursday or Friday, and you can sign up by going to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab, and the instructions are there. It's only $5 a month. We're talking about the price of going to Taco Bell one day, and you'll get the entire back catalog. Almost 100 episodes are there. Every one of those. Of course, you're going to ask yourself, well, I don't know if I'd like Expanded Perspectives Elite. I know I like Expanded Perspectives. Well, if you like Expanded Perspectives, you're going to like Elite because it's exactly the same show. It's just ones that you're not hearing. They're about the same length, an hour long. We discuss the same type of topics. When you're a really big fan of Expanded Perspectives, you're only listening to half of our stuff. So you should really go over there and sign up. Also, if you'd like to share your story with the show, don't forget you can email us, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call us, 817-945-3828. Of course, you can follow me and Cam on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or all the other places. You know what I mean. Cam, how's your Snapchat going? Is that doing good?
It's one way I can keep up with my nieces and my nephew and my son and all that stuff.
I don't have it at all.
I can't figure it. Dude, I don't understand it. You know, they told me like, oh, yeah, you got to get it. You're going to enjoy it. It's fun. All this stuff. I got it. I don't really enjoy it. I think I'm fixing to delete it. I think it's dumb. I'm like, look, I like Instagram. I'm a huge fan of Instagram. I love all that stuff on there. But the whole Snapchat thing, I'm like, if you want to send me a picture, man, just send me a picture.
Yeah. And it doesn't disappear, right?
I guess what it's for is it's for like some TNA stuff. You know, there's supposed to be some stuff that goes on, slides into them DMs, some little dark and dirty stuff. I don't get that. Like, I get like my nieces and my nephew and my son and them. I get their like half drunken escapades and debauchery that running around in college life gets them. So I'm like, I don't want to see
this. And all these youngsters are always like, well, yeah, but the picture, you know, only lasts a little while, then it disappears. I'm like, yeah, do you really believe that?
Yeah, you know, they can screenshot it. And they go, oh, yeah, but it tells you. I'm like, well, just because it tells you they screenshot it, are you going to go kick somebody's ass, make them delete your photo? It's not going to happen.
It's being stored in Utah. Remember?
Yeah, right? Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah. Good call. My bad. Yeah.
Well, I hope everybody has a good week. Stay out of trouble. For you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.